much for hosting me here and for organizing this talk. I'm very happy to present this work here. So, as Ravi said, I'm going to talk about quantum reference frames. So, basically, the idea how does a quantum system see the world? And so quantum reference frames have been discussed a lot in the literature, mainly within a quantum information perspective. So what we are concerned with here is with the covariance of physical laws. So in other words, we want to see how the laws of quantum mechanics are formulated and in which sense we can extend the principle of covariance when we consider reference frames as physical systems and possibly quantum. So before I tell you what we mean more precisely by quantum reference frames, let me just give you an introduction on how reference frames are usually treated in physics. So typically, reference frames are considered as abstract entities, which are useful to fix the point of view from which observations are carried out. So what does this mean concretely? This means that we usually fix a set of axes, so some position, some time, and then we describe physical systems with respect to this grid that we built. And so, as I said, reference frames are useful to fix the point of view, but then there is a very nice property of physics. Maybe I should. A very nice property of physics, which is the principle of covariance, that tells us that in the end, the laws of physics are independent of our choice of the reference frame. Now, let us imagine that we want to change the reference frame. So we want to go from this initial reference frame to a different reference frame. And so the way this is usually done is we define a transformation, some f, which depends on the old coordinates and the old time. And this maps this set of axes into a new set of axes here with some new position and possibly some new time, from whose point of view this physical system will also be described. But what I would like to draw your attention on here is that the relation between the new reference frame and the old reference frame enters in this transformation f as a parameter. So it's not a dynamical quantity. And so this brings me to the assumptions for idealized reference frames. And typically, we can split them in two main ones. The first one is that when we consider reference frame as idealized systems, then we always assume that it's possible, even in principle, to associate some position and some momentum with arbitrary precision to the reference frame. And the second one is that these don't have dynamical degrees of freedom. So this is what I was saying just then, that the relation is a function. They don't have dynamic, they don't have Hamiltonian equations of motion. But now we can think a bit more carefully. And we can notice that whenever we want to carry out some observation, this observation will also be carried out by using physical systems because our detectors are physical systems and obey the laws of physics. And also, whenever we want to take something as a reference, this is also going to be a physical system. So in other words, if I want to know the distance between this wall and this table, I will just take a ruler, I will just put one end to the wall, I will measure the distance to the table. And ultimately, this physical system that we use as reference can also be quantum. So the question is, can we relax these two assumptions and can we have a framework for quantum mechanics which does not rely on these two assumptions here? And this is what I would like to talk about today. So let's just start all over again. Now, we say that a reference frame is a physical system and it obeys the laws of physics. And this means that also the physical system will have some x of t and p of t, which will be the solutions of some Hamilton equation of motion. And so basically the reference frame also has some dynamical degrees of freedom associated to it. In addition, we would like a formalism which doesn't care whether this system is classical or quantum. So, yes.
Oh, sorry. You're talking about x and p as references, but what about t? I noticed t in this formula.
Yes.
Are you considering also clocks as reference?
No, frames? So far, no. No. This is without, so this is all in a Galilean setting. So, this is where time is a parameter. So, we're not taking into account effects of clocks, but this would, of course, be a very interesting question. We would like the formalism to describe quantum mechanical situations, but also have a classical limit. And going back to the two assumptions to have idealized reference frames, so we can relax these two assumptions independently. In particular, if we relax the classicality assumption, then we talk about quantum reference frames. And this, we call this the kinematics. So this means that this deals with the structure of the Hilbert space, with what the relative state is in different reference frames, and with superposition and entanglement properties. While if we relax the second assumption, the absence of dynamical evolution, then we talk about dynamical reference frames. And these will take care of the temporal evolutions and the laws of motion. These two assumptions can be independently relaxed, but they're both, so both these squares are necessary and complementary to have a full theory of quantum reference frames and with dynamics also. Okay, so this is the outline of what I would like to talk about today. So the first part deals with the kinematics. So I'm going to tell you, I'm going to introduce this transformation between two different quantum reference frames, and I'm going to see what the relative state looks like and how it is transformed. Then I'm going to move on to the dynamics. And in particular, I will show you what happens to the Schrödinger equation when we transform to a different quantum reference frame. And then these are three examples of transformations. So this one is simply when we have the reference frames, this simply displaced is in a superposition of locations. This one here, it's instead is when one reference frame moves in a superposition of different velocities from the point of view of the old one. And this last one is a generalization of the weak equivalence principle, so the universality of free fall, to quantum reference frames. So it will be a reference frame moving in a superposition of accelerations. And so if there are no questions, I can move on to the dynamics. To the kinematics. Okay, so. Yes.
So when you talk about weak equivalence principle, you're still talking about flat space time,
yes.
Galilean space time. You're not talking about.
No. Constant uniform acceleration, which is equivalent to a uniform gravitational field, but it's flat space time.
Okay. It's hard to see how it could fail, but anyway, maybe
you'll No,
get
it doesn't
maybe
fail.
We'll get
that's a.
But I mean, why is it? Well, I shouldn't ask it now, but why is it not a tautology that it?
Yes,
holds?
You can ask me later, in
okay.
case you have questions. Yes. Yes. By the way, just interrupt me at any point, if there are questions. Okay. So, one aspect of that we are considering, so we are adopting a relational approach to physics. So. What does this mean? This means that the description of the quantum state is always given in terms of relative quantities. So in other words, if I'm standing here and I'm looking at all of you, I will say that your position relative to me is the position that I associate. But then, so in particular, if I stand in C, this is the position of A, this vector here which points upwards, and this vector here is the position of B. If I move now to B, this will be the position of A from the point of view of B, and this will be the position of C from the point of view. So a direct consequence of this is that different observers assign a different quantum state to the system. So now, the most natural definition of relational quantities is what is usually done in classical physics. So this is just a classical argument. So if I have a system of n particles, I can just choose one as my reference, and then I can calculate the relative position and relative momenta, where this is the reduced mass. But then I can calculate the Poisson brackets between this quantity here and this quantity here, where I is different to j, and I find that this is different to zero. So in other words, this means that this transformation is not a canonical transformation. And this can be a problem, because we know that if we want to map a Hamiltonian system to another Hamiltonian system, the canonical transformations give us a very clear prescription for how to do that. Well, in general, if I don't have a canonical transformation, it is not guaranteed that the system will still be a Hamiltonian system. So what we do is we choose, for example, relative positions, but that can also be relative momenta or any other quadrature in the phase space. And then we complete the transformation canonically. So we choose a set of relational variables that we're interested in, and then we complete the transformation. And okay, so for example, this is the easiest case. It's the relative coordinates. And so from now on, I will always consider three systems. A, which will be the new reference frame, so the reference frame to which I want to jump. B is a physical system, it's just a system that is useful to have. And C is the old reference frame. So if I stand in C and I only consider relational quantities, then I'm not associating any position to C, because C defines my origin. So I will have the position of A and the position of B. And then now, if I want to change to the description that A gives, I have to consider the relative coordinates of B and C from the point of view of A. And this can be achieved by this transformation. And you can see it very intuitively, because if I just change the direction of this arrow, then I find precisely this vector here. And instead, this vector here can be obtained by taking this vector minus this vector. And now, let us consider, for example, so this is our old reference frame, this set of axes. And I have a quantum system B that has some wave path, has some state, quantum state. And this is the position of the system. Now, say that I want to go to this reference frame here, which is simply translated. So I only want to translate the origin of my reference frame. So in quantum mechanics, I know how to do that very well. I'll just apply a translation operator to the state. And this so the effect of this translation operator is that before I have my cat xb, and then I will have the cat xb minus alpha. But now, let's say that instead of having a reference frame which is very sharply localized around some position, this is also a physical system, and it's a quantum system. So it has some wave packet, and this wave packet is spread in position basis. So now it is not clear anymore which position I should take here to translate this state. And a possibility is that we apply the principle of linear superposition. So this means that I will translate by all possible values of x, and then I will weigh my translation over the wave packet of A. So if I write everything down like that, I will see that this is equivalent to having this operator here, where if you compare it with this one, you can see that the parameter here becomes an operator acting on the Hilbert space of the new reference frame. While I also had to add state corresponding to the quantum reference frame. And clearly you can see that if this is very sharply localized in X, I just put an X here and this goes back to this one. So now this is not the end of the story, because at this point I applied this control translation, if you want, on B, but I still have A. While we said that when I go to the reference frame of A, I don't want A anymore. And so the full operator is this one, where this PAC is parity and swap. So it ensures that we have this transformation here. So this part of the transformation is given by this operator here. So it basically sends x to minus q, and it swaps the labels A and C. OK, and at this point, the state is transformed unitarily. So this is a unitary transformation. And this is, then the state is transformed unitarily. So if I have the state of A and B from the point of view of C, after this transformation, I have the state of B and C from the point of view of A. OK. And this approach is also more general than just a classical, a reference frame transformation where the reference frame is just a function, because it allows to consider some wave packets instead of very sharp positional velocities. And also, now I drew this as a product state, but nothing prevents us from having this as an entangled state. And maybe to clarify what I mean by this, it's useful to consider some examples. So first of all, we want to check that everything works as it should when the reference frame of the new reference frame A is very sharply localized in position basis. And instead, the state of B can be any quantum state. So remember that this is the transformation that you're applying, and this is the way the state transforms. And this is just a pictorial representation of the situation. So if from the point of view of C, the state of A is this one and the state of B is this one, when I change to the reference frame of A, then what I would expect is to see C in minus this position, and always sharply localized, and B also just simply translated. So I just want to have a classical translation. And this is what we find. So as you can see, the shape is the same, but it's just translated. Now we can consider a situation which is slightly more complicated. So this is a quantum superposition of two states of this type, so very sharply localized. And this is just any quantum state. So now, what would we expect? So we would expect that if I stand here, I will see C with this relative distance from my new reference frame, and B at this distance. Well, if I stand here, I will see C at this distance, and B at this distance. But this is a quantum superposition. So if I sum these two transformations in a quantum superposition, I will get an entangled state. And this is what I get. So this is an entangled state where it's precisely what I described. So this and this and this and this. And so the only thing I wanted you to maybe to pay attention to is that here we started from a product state, and here we get an entangled state. So this means that the notion of entanglement, and also of superposition, as we will see, will depend on the quantum reference frame.
Can I just clarify what degree of freedom is entangled in this?
X position. And also in the other basis. Entanglement is for.
So I mean, I appreciate what we're trying to do, but pictorially, it's really a sum of the two graphs on the left, right, with C and B of one separation plus C and B of the other, right?
Yes, but in a superposition, yeah. OK, now we can consider if, yes.
I got slightly lost. So what Hilbert space are all these things living in? Is it a
X.
joint Hilbert space for A, B, and C, or just?
Yeah, so
just
no.
A, just
okay.
B, just C, mm-hmm. or
so
some combination?
The total Hilbert space is an infinite dimensional Hilbert space where we have so continuous variables. So it's isomorphic to L2
of
R.
Of R.
L2 of
so
R, yeah.
So there's only one coordinate.
Yes, yes, this is one dimension. Yes,
okay.
One dimension. And it's the product, at the beginning, it's the product of the Hilbert spaces of A and B, which is isomorphic to the tensor product of the Hilbert spaces of B and C in the new reference frame, because it's a unitary transformation.
Okay.
Okay, any other?
A, B to B, C. Okay.
You're just basically repartitioning the Hilbert space. This is the meaning of
this
transformation.
This row, B, C lives in the tensor product
yes.
of the B and the C
yes.
Hilbert space.
Yes. Okay, so. This other case instead is a case where we have an entangled state of A and B, where the relative distance between A and B is always L in the two amplitudes. Now, following the opposite reasoning to this one, if B is always at the same distance to A, then A should see B in a very sharp position. And again, this is what happens. B is in a sharp position, and C is in a superposition of two different positions here. Now we can just push this a bit further. So we can consider an EPR state where, again, so this is a non-normalized EPR state, but the idea is the same. So we have A in a position X, and B always at same relative position, and then this is integrated over X. And this is the pictorial representation. And then if we want to go to the reference frame of A, then we would like to see B in a well-defined position, and C instead will just be spread out the whole space.
Sorry.
Yeah.
There's one more thing I'm missing, which is that how if you are making X as an operator, right? How would you guarantee that you for the third case the length L is a definite number?
So this is just like this.
Okay, so yeah. There's some means to know that at the beginning before I change frame A and B is.
Yes, 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 yes.
So familiar in the picture, that symmetry is accidental between A and B in the lower left picture.
Which picture?
The lower left. I mean, A and
left.
B are entangled, but it looks like they're an equal separation apart in both cases. Is that deliberate or is that just accidental?
No, we wanted this state. We chose this initial state.
So A and B are in superposition, but in one they're
yes.
close and the other
yes.
far apart. That's what happens.
Then it will still be an entangled state in the new reference frame.
Okay, so you go from entangled to entangled
yes.
in general.
Yes, yes, yes. Okay, so if there are no more questions, I can move on to the dynamics. Okay, so as I said before, then we would like to associate some dynamical evolution, so some Hamiltonian to the quantum reference frame. And what does it mean that, well, we will have classically, you will have the reference frame will have some trajectory, and you can calculate the solutions to the Hamilton's equations. But the important thing is that from the point of view of C, C will see a Hamiltonian of A and B. From the point of view of A will see a Hamiltonian of B and C. So how would we treat this situation classically? So again, the Hamiltonian changes with a canonical transformation. So we know how to change the Hamiltonian with a canonical transformation, and this will just be the old Hamiltonian in the new variables and plus the partial time derivative of the generating function of the canonical transformation. And now, so this is basically conceptually what happens, but let's see how we can describe this in a quantum mechanical situation. And this will mainly be basically substituting the usual Hamilton's equation of motion with the Schrödinger equation. So now we assume that in the reference frame C, we have this Schrödinger equation, where this is the Hamiltonian of A and B, and this is the state. Now, if we have that Schrödinger equation, we want to apply a transformation S. Now, S is just a general unitary transformation. It doesn't have anything to do, in principle, with the S to change to relative coordinates that I introduced a few slides ago, just general. So if we change the reference frame with such transformation, then we still get a Schrödinger equation where this state is simply the transform state to the new reference frame. And the Hamiltonian transforms in this way, which is very similar to the classical case, because this part here is equivalent to re-expressing x and p in terms of the transform variables. And this is equivalent to the partial time derivative of the generating function of the canonical transformation. So the classical and the quantum picture match. And the evolution in the new quantum reference frame is unitary. So this allows me to define what we mean by an extended symmetry in quantum reference frames. In particular, so say that we start from this Hamiltonian, and this Hamiltonian has some functional form, which will possibly depend on the coordinates of A and B, on the momenta of A and B, and on the masses of A and B. So we say that a quantum reference frame transformation defines a symmetry transformation if the transformed Hamiltonian has the same functional form as the initial Hamiltonian, but just with all A's, which become C. So all the XA in this Hamiltonian become QC, all the BA become pi C, so the new momenta, and all the MA's become MC. This is what we mean, and now I will give you two examples to make this clear, hopefully.
When you change to the new frame, right? Yes. You change the Hamiltonian.
Yes.
Right? But do you not change the time parameter too?
No, the time doesn't change so far. Okay. This is just a Galilean setting, so time is a parameter.
So
it's an external parameter.
So the generator of time translation stays the same.
Yeah.
Have you told us what S is yet?
It's just a unitary transformation, which
it could be anything.
It's general. Yeah. Yeah, so far it's general. I'm going to specify it in the two examples. Okay, yes, actually this is related to your question. So S is not the most general function that you can think about, but it has a structure. And in particular, okay, so let's analyze piece by piece. So this one is, this is the Hamiltonian of A, so just of the system A. And this takes, so imagine that we are applying this transformation to the state. This takes the state of A from time t to time zero, okay? Then I'm going to explain better, but I need to tell you this first. So this part here, which is really the core of the quantum reference frame transformation, is the equivalent of a classical reference frame transformation, where instead of parameters, we have operators. What do I mean? That if I perform a classical reference frame transformation, then I will also have a unitary operator, where here I want to put the relation between the two reference frames. So if it moves with constant velocity or constant acceleration or even like something more complicated. And what we do in this quantum reference frame, in quantum reference frames, is just we put a hat on that. How? We take the Hamiltonian of A, we solve the equations of motion, and we find the relation between, in terms of operators, so in the Heisenberg picture, between the old reference frame and the new reference frame. And this means that if here I have something in the Heisenberg picture, I cannot apply it to a state which is in the Schrödinger picture for A, because otherwise I have a double counting. And this is why I have to evolve the state of A back in time. Because if I leave it at time t, then here I have an operator in the Heisenberg picture, and so I'm just going to count the reference frame transformation twice. Okay, then I have... Then I have this operator here, which is a generalized parity operator. What does it mean? This operator here is the generalization of what we have seen with the parity and swap. And it depends on the specific transform. So this I here is because it depends on the specific transformation. So if I want to have a superposition of translations or superposition of Galilean boosts, this can be a bit different. And what this takes care of is to invert the equations of motion. Because physically, what I want to have is that the position of the new reference frame is minus the position of the old reference frame. And also, in general, the equations of motion should be opposite. So for example, the velocity should be opposite. Because if I'm moving here and I'm looking at you, I will see you moving with minus the velocity, which you will see me moving. So this is physically what it means.
There's something I didn't understand. Typically, we would apply this unitary to a state.
Yes.
And we wouldn't let the unitary be correlated with the choice of state, like that it should be able to operate on any state. But it seemed like you described the I parameter as being something that depends on which state you're going to feed into the unitary.
Okay, so it's not on it doesn't depend on the state. It depends on the specific change of quantum reference frame, so on the specific transformation. So for instance, if I want to go to a reference frame which is simply translated, or a reference frame which is boosted, or a reference frame which is moving with some acceleration. So this is why this operator changes, but not on the state. I don't know if this was clear.
So you mean it's sort of more depends on the symmetry group for which the reference frame is a reference frame. Is it a reference frame for position? Is it a reference frame for velocity? But not whether I have a superposition or whether I have...
Yes, it doesn't depend on whether you have a superposition or an entangled state. It just depends on the specific transformation of reference frame. Maybe if I give you the two examples, this will be clear. But ask me again if it's not.
Okay.
Maybe if you say what the index I represents, that will help.
Yeah, that was one of my questions.
Okay. Yeah, so for I can be, for example, translation, boosts, accelerated
so
reference frame.
The type of
reference frame. Yeah.
And so the I on the unitary is likewise the same index.
Yes. That's
so
precisely
that
why.
There should be an I associated with the Fs.
I ran out of space where to put
okay.
the index, but yes,
right.
To be precise, there should be an I
what's
here.
What's n? Like, what is this product taken to be over?
This is just to consider the most general situation that you can have, because maybe you want to consider a combination of boost and translation, for instance.
Okay.
And then you will write as
so
a product of two
be
exponents.
A translation, n equals 2 could be a boost, n equals 3 could be a boost.
Yeah, it can, it just, you have a product of different exponentials, and
okay.
It's just to consider a more general situation.
And what's the O hats? Are they conjugate to the Fs always? Like in your earlier examples, it was X and P hat.
Yeah, that's a good question. So in general, we don't have an answer for that. So we don't know like precisely up to which point the so if there is really a relation between these two. So what I can tell you is that in the cases we considered, this is just the usual, for example, either translation generator or boost generator. And this just substitutes the equations of motion. So there doesn't seem to be really a strict connection. But for example, if I have, we will see in the boost transformation that instead of V, we'll have P divided by M.
So I decide what O is, then I compute F from the equations of motion, then I turn it into an operator,
yeah.
And then I do this.
Yes. Yes.
Another question.
Yeah.
So when you say that, when you say that greater than or equal to P is a swap, is it correct? It's normally think of a swap as acting within a fixed Hilbert space, but this swap is kind of between two different Hilbert spaces. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
Yes, that's why we call it generalized parity operator, because we are also changing the partition of the total space. But then after I apply this operator, then I'm still left, if you remember, with the state that, well, now it's the state of C in the Heisenberg picture, because I went to the Heisenberg picture for this state before. And so I just have to put it back in the Schrödinger picture with this term. So this is why this is there. Okay. So I will give you now the example. So hopefully, I know this was quite abstract. Hopefully this will clarify. So here we want to go to a quantum reference frame, which is in a superposition of positions. Now, if we have a reference frame, which is also dynamical, we really have to define what we mean by quantum reference frame translation. And what we mean is, imagine that I have a state of A in particular. This is our new reference frame. And A is evolving according to some Hamiltonian. And now I want to fix a time, a specific time tau. And I say, OK, this is the state that I want to consider and define all my relational variables with respect to this state. And so this is what we mean when we say the superposition of translations. And OK, so just for simplicity, let's just consider a free particle Hamiltonian to start with. And so the usual standard translation is just x of t is x0. But now if we have some dynamical equations of motion, this is again the, so we have to take the, in the Heisenberg picture, basically, we have to take these two times tau. So this is how this translates in the quantum reference frame language. We have to evolve it two times tau, and this tau defines our reference frame. And this is what the transformation is like. So as you can see, this is basically the SX. So it's a transformation to relative quantities, so relative coordinates that I introduced before. And here I just put this tau in the Hamiltonian that was before and after. So I just didn't act with the tau on this x, but this x is this x, and this is this tau, basically. And so you can also see that what this operator meant in a dynamical context is when t is always equal to tau. So this means that this operator here is giving us the transformation to relative variables, to relative positions, of a system which is following in time. So I'm evolving the system, and for every time, I take the relative coordinates. While if instead tau is not equal to t, it's just some fixed tau, it can also be zero, then I'm just defining a time and calculate the relative positions, always with respect to this time.
So can I ask, I'm sorry, so in the upper line, the thing beside the red arrow, I have tau dependence on the right and t dependence on the left. How do I understand
it's
that's supposed to be that
t minus tau.
One line up. You've got x hat of t.
Yes, okay, yes.
Should that be a tau?
So no, this is a t because it's the same way in this which this is a t. So this is a function of t which is a constant. So it's a specific type of function of t, which is just flat.
So the x hat of t on the left actually does not depend on t.
No. So this doesn't depend on t, and this also doesn't depend. Yeah, maybe the notation is a bit misleading.
The thing on the left must depend on tau, because the thing on the right does.
No, because this is the what we usually consider as a translation in for abstract reference frames, when reference frames don't have any dynamical, any Hamiltonian associated to them. So we just say, okay, it's translated, it's in that position, and I just translate the origin of my axis to the other position.
Tau independent?
Yes. Just because the reference frame doesn't have any dynamical equation of motion associated.
The reference frame is at rest on the left, is that right?
Yes, yes, this is what it means. Yes.
So then does the one on the right, does the x hat A implicitly depend on tau then?
No, this depends on tau, yeah, sorry, this depends on tau but not on t.
Okay.
Is the operator in the exponential, that lowercase x hat? Is that distinct from the uppercase x hat?
So this x is this x. And so you have to just put also this part here and this part here in order to get.
What is this capital T on the left?
This is just a label for the type of transform. This means S translation. A name. Okay, so if we transform this initial Hamiltonian with this transformation here, then we find that the new Hamiltonian is this one. And this is precisely what I said. So if you see here, all the A's become C. So I still have a free particle Hamiltonian, so it's same functional form, and A is C. PA becomes pi c, MA becomes MC. So this is what we define as an extended symmetry for the quantum reference frame.
So when you did this transformation, there was a term that involved ds dt.
Yes.
Is tau held fixed when you compute that?
Yes, yes. Tau is a number. So.
So is there one whole family of these transformations depending on the choice of tau?
Yes, yes. For every tau, there is a different one.
There's a different one. Okay.
But in this example, so dsdt happens to be zero. Oh, sorry. Sorry, you were talking about a fault.
Yeah, well, no, I was just wondering, physically, why do we, what's the meaning of this tau? I think many people are confused about.
Okay. So if you.
You would, why not just do it each time? Why not take t equals tau?
So.
Always.
I guess this is a physical reason. Because what we want to do is we want to generalize the usual translation of in abstract reference frames. So when reference frames are not treated as a dynamical quantity. And as you also said before, this is when the new reference frame doesn't move. It's simply displaced. So we need to find an equivalent when the reference frame is actually moving. So if we follow the movement of how the reference frame moves and evolves in time, then we are not really defining a translation because we are changing the reference frame at every point. So what we do is we fix a tau, and this tau is the moment which we say, this is my reference frame. And this is my reference frame, which is just translated from the point of view of my old reference frame. And then For this fixed tau, we define the relative coordinates.
But it doesn't, that looks very arbitrary, I mean.
Well, it's a definition, yes. This is the way we interpret the...
Physically, wouldn't you want to sort of take the relative distance at the time t when you're...
You can do it. You can also do that,
and
yes.
And t equals tau, is that right?
Yes.
That amounts to t equals tau.
This amounts to t equals tau.
But then when you take that transformation, there'll be another derivative depending on tau. So I'm just wondering if it still keeps the same form.
No, it doesn't. That's the thing, yes.
So that's bad. I mean, isn't that bad? Is it bad?
I don't think it's bad. I don't think it's bad. So also, this one is a nice transformation because it gives an example of this type of extended symmetry for quantum reference frames. While if I just consider this operator here, I won't get this symmetry. And this can be understood also in a different way. So I wouldn't say that it's bad, but it's simply just what happens. And actually, we have some new work which makes it understand it from, so we consider some a system of n particles, so you can also consider that classically, with some symmetries. And then this has some gauge symmetry. And basically, we define the choice of the reference frame as a gauge fixing. And what we find is a transformation which is slightly different from this one, but not that much. You just have an additional term here. And then the reference, when we quantize it in one dimension, so in the same case as we have here, then we have that this is precisely the reference frame transformation from when we really have, we basically get rid of all the external symmetries, and we just consider the relational degrees of freedom. And so this is the transformation, and the Hamiltonian is also symmetric. But it's not the Hamiltonian of the free part. So it's not really this Hamiltonian. It has an additional term here, and it has an additional term here. So this also gives some additional confidence that this is a good transformation. And this term here is really to preserve this form of the Hamiltonian. But you can choose a different one, and in that case, you will follow also the system in its evolution in time. So it just depends on which type of transformation you are interested in doing, basically. You might have different reasons to choose one rather than the other, because maybe, I don't know, your experimental apparatus will be...
But in one case, you say it is a symmetry, and in another case, you say it's not a symmetry.
Not with this Hamiltonian.
Not with that Hamiltonian.
Yes, yes. So this is a symmetry with this Hamiltonian, and if you just consider this one, the symmetric Hamiltonian is slightly different.
So in this example, ds dt is zero?
No. It has, you have t here and t here.
Well, just in your earlier thing, you had the new h was the hs dagger plus d by dt of ss dagger. So why isn't that last term there?
This is just after you, so this is also after you compute with the last term. Is just the end result.
So the last term figures
yes.
in and it gives
yeah.
you that.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. You are saying that if we set t equals tau, is there some correction to h that makes
yes.
that a symmetry?
Yes.
And
yes.
will you tell us what to?
I can write it down if you want, yes.
Okay.
I found. Oh, okay, thanks. So the way you have to correct for the Hamiltonian, so say that we are in C and we have A and B. So this is the symmetric Hamiltonian. So basically, you see that with respect to what I had there, you add this other term, PA plus PB. And the way you can understand this term here is by writing, so imagine now step back and from an outside perspective. And so I can write Okay, so this is basically this. So this would be basically the PC squared divided by 2mc when the total momentum is conserved. Okay, so basically this just gives you, well, this. So PA plus BB equal to minus PC, and you just put it here. So basically the meaning of that is that from you can consider an outside perspective where the momentum is a constant. So this defines a this is a symmetry. And if the total momentum. And then your reference frame, you can pick your reference frame as a gauge fixing of the gauge. So you will have some gauge freedom. Then with a gauge fixing, you can define that condition. And you can go to the reference frame of A or the reference frame of C or the reference frame of B, and everything is transitive, basically. So you can just compose the transformation to
the way. It's interesting because this introduces an interaction between A and B, between the reference frame and the system that it's observing, whereas until now you didn't have any such interaction.
No, here we don't have it, yes. But yeah, you can also have that, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, maybe here? Okay, so the second example I would like to show you is the superposition of Galilean boosts. Okay, so let's first maybe revise what the Galilean boost is. So the Galilean boost is a transformation which allows us to go to a reference frame which is moving with constant and uniform velocity from the point of view of the initial one. And we have a unitary representation of the boost, where this is the generator, which is just momentum times t minus m times x. And v is the relative velocity of the new reference frame from the point of view of the old one. And the boost is a symmetry of the free particle, because if I consider the free particle Hamiltonian and I compute the new Hamiltonian, then I will still have a free particle Hamiltonian in particular. So it also holds when I have some interacting potential, but let's just forget about this for the moment. And so now what we want to do is we want to consider an extension to quantum reference frames of this. And how do we do it? So let's say that we stand in C, and A obeys some equations of motion such that she moves in a superposition of V1 and V2. Now, if I had to add to use the transformation that we had in the previous slide, where V is just a parameter, I wouldn't know which one to put. And now what we want to do is to generalize it to quantum reference frames. And as I think you have understood, we just put a hat on the V, basically. So let's start from a free particle Hamiltonian. And in this case, this is really important because this gives us the condition that the momentum is conserved. And so the new transformation, as you can see here, we have PA divided by MA, which is the boost. So which is the velocity, basically, according to the equations of motion. And again, we have these two terms here. Now, this is an example where the parity and swap operator is different to the one that we have seen in the translation case, where it just does x goes to minus x and p goes to minus p. This one sends the momentum of C is minus the momentum of A with this ratio between the masses. And this is important because this ensures that the velocity of C is equal to minus the velocity of A. So this is what I meant when I said that this ensures that the equations of motion are one the opposite of the other. And again, if we calculate the new Hamiltonian using this expression, then we find again that we have the free particle Hamiltonian, well, all A's are turned into C's. And for what concerns the state, say that we start from this very simple state, which is just a superposition of two velocities for A and any state for B. When we transform it, we see that when A was moving with V1, then C moves with minus V1, and B is boosted by V1. And when A was moving with V2, C moves with minus V2, and B is boosted by V2. So everything works as we would expect. OK, so now the last example. The weak equivalence principle. So, as
last one thing before you go to, in the last one, did the coordinates also transform as you would expect the x's?
So the coordinates of B, yes, they transform as you would expect.
Not just the velocities, but the coordinates.
Yes, yes, the coordinates of B. The coordinates of A, it's a bit more complicated because if so, what we find is that you have to trade the. So here, what really is meaningful is the velocity. So, but since you cannot have relative coordinates and relative momenta at the same time, then when you choose relative momenta, you have to trade this for a complicated expression of the positions.
So it's the same, physically the reference frame is the same system, just a free particle.
Yes.
But you're using it in one case as a reference for position, and in the other case,
yes,
as a reference
yes.
for
yes.
velocity.
Yes, 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 yes.
Mm-hmm. Of course, real reference frames we use for both. But anyway,
this is an interesting point. Yes. Okay. So, what do we mean by weak equivalence principle? We mean that the physical effects as seen from a reference frame moving with constant and uniform acceleration are indistinguishable from those as seen in a uniform gravitational field. And OK, so this is also the universality of free fall. So if the inertial mass is the same as the gravitational mass, then A is equal to G. And pictorially, this can be described in this way. So if A is accelerated, and we are in the reference frame of C initially, then there is a transformation, which is an extended Galilean transformation, which was defined by Greenberger in 1979, and which takes us to another classical reference frame A, from whose point of view B in particular evolves as if it was in a uniform gravitational field with acceleration g equal to minus A. And so now, I think you understood how these quantum reference frames work. So what we mean by the generalization is that the physical effects as seen from a reference frame moving in a superposition of constant and uniform accelerations are indistinguishable from those as seen in a superposition of uniform gravitational fields. And so again, this means that we basically put hats on the acceleration and on G. And what does this mean for this? So this picture changes a little bit. And we will have a superposition of accelerations here. And here, in particular, B, we would like it to see if it moves with a superposition of accelerations, as if it was in a superposition of uniform gravitational fields. Now, let's try to make it a bit more systematic. How do we realize this situation? So this time we start from this Hamiltonian of A and B, where V of xA is a piecewise linear potential. So it has this shape here. And we choose the initial state in such a way, so this is a superposition of coherent states, so Gaussian states, in such a way that this amplitude here fits perfectly in just one slope and this one fits in one's law. We also assume that we just consider a time evolution for some time t until some time t, where this has, so the slope in which this coherent state fits hasn't changed. So it's always in the same region of this piecewise cylindrical potential. And under these conditions, we will see that, so we can derive that this psi 1, so this state here, evolves as if it was constantly accelerated with A1. And the other coherent state, psi 2 here, evolves as if it was constantly accelerated with A2. And now we can define a generalization of the Greenberger transformation to an accelerated reference frame. And so it always has this Hamiltonian here and this Hamiltonian here. And then this is the core of the transformation is this one, where this operator QT is very complicated, but the only important thing is that it's just a straightforward generalization of the Greenberger, of the classical Greenberger operator. So again, we take the Greenberger operator, we solve these equations of motion, we put hats where in that transformation you had parameters, and this is this Q, nothing more. And so we can, now we can calculate the new Hamiltonian starting from this one with this operator here. And this is what we find. So let's see what we have. So we have here this potential rescaled by the masses, and this is just because we want the two accelerations to be one the opposite of the other. And this one here is very, so here it would be very tempting to say that B moves as if it was in a superposition of accelerations, of uniform gravitational fields. Because we have M, this is the acceleration operator that you can see is this one here, and Q, QB. So it's like MGX, but where G has a hat. But we cannot say that at this level, because we don't know how the state transforms. So without knowing how the state transforms, we cannot conclude what we would like to conclude. But if we look at how the state transforms, then we see that this is just a transformed coherent state. And in this one, in this amplitude here, which corresponds to this part here of the state, we just have the state of B. So basically, you just have the standard Greenberger operator with acceleration A1 acting on this coherent state, on this state here. So this doesn't need to be a coherent state. And for this one here, for this amplitude here, we just have the standard Greenberger operator with acceleration A2. So under these conditions, now we can say that B moves as if it were in a superposition of gravitational fields. And this is basically everything I wanted to tell you. So just to summarize, what I've shown here is an operational approach to reference frame as physical systems. And we have seen that we have two parts to this problem. The first part is the kinematics, which deals with the Hilbert space structure, entanglement, and superposition properties. The second part is the dynamics, which instead deals with the laws of motion. And then the question is, can we describe the world from the point of view of such a quantum reference frame? So when we associate to a reference frame also some quantum, so a Hilbert space and a Hamiltonian. And the answer is yes, we can, but we need to generalize the laws of transformation to for the reference frame. And we have seen how this leads to a generalization of the notion of covariance, which also needs to take into account the Hamiltonian of the reference frame itself. And we have seen how this works in the superposition of spatial translations and in the superposition of Galilean boosts. And then we have seen that also the weak equivalence principle can be generalized to when the system moves in a superposition of two different accelerations. And this is all. Thank you.
This is very nice. Thank you. I want to confirm that I've understood correctly. In the first half, where we're just talking about stack graph frames, quite a lot. The unitary that you defined, which swaps the operator algebras of A and C, that could be applied, even if the quantum state of A was not pure. Right, so there's nothing here that requires the quantum state of A to be pure. If it's mixed, I can do this just as well. And so in particular, if I didn't care about a quantum generalization, but rather a generalization to what you might call the statistical case, where I have classical uncertainty about what's going on, this formalism applies equally well. I just say everything's density operators that are diagonal on some fixed basis that describes my classical uncertainty. And all those diagrams that you have with the Gaussians on them, I could, if I wanted to, just say, oh, let's think of those as possible probability distributions. Everything you said would have gone through is that your uncertainty gets shifted, and sometimes your uncertainty turns into correlated uncertainty.
Yes, you're right. Yes, yes.
And is it true for the second half of your talk as well that nothing relied on purity, everything could be done for mixed states, and therefore it subsumes the statistical case?
Yeah, you just have in the Schrödinger equation, you just put a state which is just a mixture of classical states, basically. And then you have the dynamical equations of motion, but this is also fine. Because also the Hamiltonian, so since it's really just a translation of the classical case, the Hamiltonian, you just, instead of, you have just a unitary operator acting on the Hamiltonian instead of having the classical way in which the Hamiltonian transforms with the canonical transformation. Then, but formally, like at the algebraic level, the transformation is the same. And so you can as well define it also for classical states and everything goes through, I would say.
So like open system dynamics as well, like instead of having a Hamiltonian, you have a Liouville equation.
Yeah, these are, so we haven't tried that. So I cannot tell you, like I calculated these and I found that it also applies.
But there's nothing, no obstacle.
There's no, I don't see any in principle obstacle at least.
So when the translation is, translation between, even classically as a complicated expression, which I take it the Greenberger one is, at least, won't there be sort of factor ordering ambiguities in how you implement it quantum mechanically?
Okay, so in this case, there are none because of the particular form of the Hamiltonian. So we just, and also remember that in the transformation, we always have the operator acting on the system, which can be, I don't know, like for example, the generator of the boosts, for instance. And this is on one Hilbert space, on the Hilbert space of B, for example. And then what you quantize that used to be a parameter is on a different Hilbert space. So these two commute. So in this case, there are no factoring ambiguities on these two parts of the transformation. And also in all the other cases that we have tried, there are no factoring ambiguities. Also within the same Hilbert space. It always worked.
I see. So if it... So the related question is, have you tried to do this for Lorentz transformations? I mean, why did you pick the non-relativistic?
Because it's easier.
Why is it easier? It's not factor ordering, but what is it that makes it easier?
Well, for instance, we have this nice representation in terms of particles, for instance, while if you go to quantum field theory,
quantum field theory is, of course, harder. But
yes. So actually,
a free particle can be a reference frame.
A free particle can be a reference frame. Yes. Yes.
Even in Minkowski space.
Yes. So actually, we are working on that now. So.
I see.
I think I have a related question. So it's about the notion of locality. Many ways to consider locality in physics. But one way is to consider some velocity bound. Like the speed of light, faster than the speed of light. Now you have a superposition of velocity, and then you can transform coordinate systems. I wonder if you go to say the Lorentzian mm-hmm. case, would you have an analog motion of locality?
I don't think I understand your question.
So how would you formulate no superluminous signaling in your theory? How do you formulate a velocity bound in your theory?
A velocity bound is no problem. I mean, you just replace the Galilean boost with the Lorentz boost. And you just...
I think the question is, if you were to describe... I mean, if we try to describe no signaling, we imagine
yes.
external observers, and we say that the one cannot transmit
uh-huh.
information to the other if they're space-like.
I see.
If
okay.
you make them both quantum systems,
I see.
Now, how do you describe?
I see. Okay.
That sort of the question you're asking.
Okay. Everything here presupposes the Galilean subtext, so
yes,
would have to be thought up.
Yes. Yes. And actually, so every time you make, for example, a local measurement here, then when you change the reference frame, you transform both the state and the observable. So in the end, the probabilities are conserved. So if the probability gives you the signaling properties, then you're fine.
I have a question about the experiment. When we have a particle such as a molecule, let's say in a plane wave state, and we shoot it towards a double slit, then we know what happens. But with your formalism, can you go into the rest frame of that particle? Because if you can, wouldn't that mean that the particle is always, it's always clear where it is, where the molecule is, because you're working in its rest frame. Then it's the walls of the double
yes.
slit that are in a funny arrangement. And
yes.
Right? So that's
yes.
what we would get, right?
Yes, that's what precisely what we would get.
It's a different view on what the double slit experiment
yes. Actually, there is also this example of you have an interferometer that you build, and you send a particle in the interferometer. Now, say that it's a slow particle, so that we can use this description. And so while an experimentalist will see the particle moving in a superposition towards a beam splitter, which at the end is at the end of the interferometer and is fixed, if you are the particle, then you will see the beam splitter approaching in a superposition of directions. But in such a way that at the end the probability of having like output one or output two are the same. I don't know.
So do you see a way of generalizing what you do to cases where, for example, I might want to talk about the phase or the angle
mm-hmm.
Of a system relative to some axis. Right? So I could have like a z-axis, and I just want to know what angle am I from the x-axis. So
yes.
that's a kind of reference.
Yes.
But now that we're talking about phase, the kind of prescription you describe where you just add hats is not going to work. Because although I can generate a rotation by just taking e to the phi jz, where jz is the angular minimum operator, there's no phase operator whose canonical commutation relation with the angular minimum operator mimics
okay.
the classical case. So there's no possibility of just saying, oh, we're going to add a hat to phi and use this prescription. You'll need to do something quite different, I think.
Okay. So my impression is that, so basically this is in one dimension, so we don't have this problem of rotations. But if you go to three dimensions, for example, and then you want to see, so I have a system here and a system here, and maybe these axes are tilted like that, and maybe this is also quantum fluctuates like that. Then my impression is that what you would have to do is to define in somehow the relative, so if I have, let's make it with the z-axis so that it's easier. So I just define this angle like that, and then I will have a controlled superposition of rotations, which are controlled by, for instance, I can describe the state of this particle in spherical coordinates, for instance, and then I can define the angle. And then the relative angle between this z and this z will control the rotation, and then you will just add the rotation. So I'm not sure what precisely the form of this transformation would be, but so I was mentioning before this other approach that we have for the gauge with the gauge fixing, and also in this case we basically see that the approach works in the same way. It's just that it's just a bit technically more cumbersome to define what the relation between these two angles, like this z and this z axis, for example, is. But the principle is the same. But I cannot tell you precisely what the shape, like exactly what the form of this transformation is. But it should go through.
Couldn't you do this in your one-dimensional example just by making the particle on a circle instead of on a line?
Make it periodic.
Yes.
Then it's an angle again, so.
Yeah, it's true, yes. Yes.
So if I understood correctly, that you could imagine that an implication of this is that there's an equivalence between entangled states in one Hilbert space and product states in other ones, which are mapped, which are connected by the swap operator that you wrote about.
So yes, there are cases in which entangled states are mapped to product states and vice versa, yes.
So that would mean that there's some, if you imagine a huge space, different Hilbert spaces, but they're connected by the swap operator, that there'd be some kind of, you know, equivalence class spanning. Like, if you imagine all the different Hilbert spaces you could reach at by writing all the physically allowed swap operators, then there would be, each state would be identified with a different one in all the possible spaces, right?
You mean in different quantum reference frames?
That's right.
Yes, yes. You would have a different transformation, but, I mean, this is not really a problem because this transformation satisfies the transitive property. So basically, if I move from C to A and from A to B or directly from A to B, then it's the same.
So if you characterized abstractly, like which operators were allowed by some set of symmetries that you thought were physical,
okay,
you can imagine simplifying the description of a quantum state by
This is what you mean.
By offloading the complexity of the state representation onto the complexity of the swap operator. You can imagine that there might be cases in which you get a favorable.
Okay.
Really a question.
Maybe, yeah. I don't know. Okay, yeah.
So this is also not a question, more a comment, but you might want to comment on the comment. There are two things. One is time. I don't know if you'll have trouble, but of course it's very hard to design a clock. It's much easier to design some sort of position reference object. Clocks have no trouble because of the positivity of Hamiltonian. So that's one. The other thing is that, of course, the aim of this, from the point of view of physics, must be we're trying to give a more realistic account of what a reference frame is. But there's still something missing, which is a real reference frame can only function if it interacts with the object that it's, you know, that it's serving as a reference frame for. So that looks like it might complicate. I'm not sure, but it looks like it might complicate the whole formalism, and I'm not sure to what extent. So, if you'd like to comment on either of those two comments, making a clock reference frame.
Yes. So the clock reference frame is really something we haven't thought about so far. So I think I cannot add anything. And regarding to this last aspect, which is the measurement, we have some measurement model in this paper. But the way we do it is just we add an ancilla, which we just treat as a physical system. So it's like a von Neumann measurement. And the ancilla interacts with the system that we want to measure. And so there is no direct interaction between the reference frame. Also because we don't describe the initial reference frame. So we need to use another system, which is like a measurement device, to couple to the system that we want to measure. And this is just what is done usually in quantum mechanics with Poincaré measurements. And then we transform everything to the new reference frame, and probabilities are conserved. This is what we find.
So I'm not sure that I understood. What are you saying, that a measurement described from the point of view of one reference frame is somehow equivalent to, compatible with the same measurement described from another reference frame?
This is a more delicate point. Yes, this is a more delicate point.
You said that. You didn't just say that.
No,
you said something.
So it's so you can visualize. So if I do a measurement in my reference frame, I can describe the same measurement from a different quantum reference frame. But performing is a more delicate thing. Like performing measurements in two different quantum reference frames is more delicate.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's, I mean, that's a very interesting question too, I think, but I'm not sure it's what I was asking. How does the reference frame get to know about the object that it's serving as the reference frame?
Yes,
for?
Yes.
How does it know?
Yes. This is also a very interesting question. Yes. Yes, so we don't have a final answer to that, and everything we have done on this is always assuming that they can communicate between each other, so they're telling each other, hey, I'm measuring. But we haven't looked into this more complicated.
Okay. Anyone has more of a question than a comment? This is your last one. Otherwise, we can thank the speaker.